morning.
Good morning.
Our first case for argument is Dalzell against County View Family Farms. Mr. DeWitt.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, may it please the court, I was not aware that we needed to clear the use of oversized exhibits first. We did bring foam boards. If that would be of use to the court, I'd be happy to put them up. If you'd rather not, I will move along.
Unless you think they are going to be very important, I would just tend to move along.
Your Honor, thank you for your advice. Because it has a bearing on how I allocate my time before this court, I want to take out the issue of waiver straight on at the very beginning. If I were in the defendant's shoes, I would be arguing the same thing that they are arguing, and I understand the basis of their claim of waiver. But the issue is really one of law, and the court took up the issue that we raise sort of in passing in its order, and so I think it's fair game. The rule of lenity here is appropriate, I think, because the issue is purely one of law. And the cases that were cited by the defendants deal a lot with the presentation of evidence. And it seems to me that if you fail to present evidence on something, you actually waive it. But if the evidentiary issues are not in dispute, and certainly with regard to how we interpret the statute, they're not really in dispute, then I think it's appropriate to apply that rule. Courts also often say that they will affirm the judgment of the trial court for any reason supported by the record, even if the trial court may have reached the result that it did for an incorrect reason. It seems to me that if you apply that rule one way, you should apply it going the other way.
The full statement of that rule is that a court can affirm on any properly preserved ground.
I would agree, Your Honor.
Which leads to the question whether this ground was properly preserved. The Supreme Court said just last term that a lawyer who knows about some issue and deliberately decides not to raise it has waived that argument. Is that a fair statement about whether you knew about the possibility that this statute was just a reinstatement of the coming to the nuisance doctrine?
Well, Your Honor, I'm a counsel on appeal, and I did not have anything to do with the case on appeal. I
mean, you can't relieve from a waiver just by changing your lawyer.
I understand that, Your Honor, but you are asking about whether or not they knew and failed to raise. I don't believe this issue crossed their minds because they were thinking that they had the issue of negligent operation. But if the court decides to apply the waiver rule, again, the court would be within the bounds of Seventh Circuit precedent and certainly Supreme Court precedent in doing that. We simply ask that the court consider the AMCAS decision and apply a rule of lenity, because if you look at the decisions of the Court of Appeals in the state of Indiana, they have been tergiversating on this issue of what this statute actually does. And I think this court, particularly...
Well, let me ask you one more question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any reason why this matters? Your adversary says that this parcel has been in agricultural use since the 1950s. That is, before your clients moved to the area.
Well, I think it matters because where the Court of Appeals in Indiana has said, seems to me that they, when they have discussed this issue, they have talked about, if you look at the Wendt case, it says the Wendts also assert the trial court erred because it codifies the doctrine of coming to the nuisance. And the court said that's essentially what it did. It also said that in TDM, the act by its plain terms was intended to prohibit non-agricultural land uses from being the basis of a nuisance suit. But in between there, we have DeGroat. So the court itself has not been clear in what the law is. So, yes, Your Honor, I think it does matter, and I think a decision from this court would help clarify that.
I don't understand how that answers my question.
Well, then perhaps I didn't understand your question, Your Honor.
I understand your adversaries correctly. They say this parcel has been in an agricultural use since the 1950s. And therefore, it was in an agricultural use for more than 1 year before your clients moved to the area, which makes this particular legal issue irrelevant and throws us back on the question whether this is a change for the purpose of a statute.
Well, Your Honor, my analysis of the case law in Wendt and TDM would suggest that that is an that's an incorrect application. But that is a decision for the court, and if the court finds that it's irrelevant, I would move on to my next issue.
Could I ask you this, please?
Yes, ma'am.
If the Right to Farm Act provides a complete defense against a nuisance suit, why would it not also provide a defense to a negligence suit that claims the exact same harm as a nuisance suit? I mean, would it really be that easy to make an end run around the Right to Farm Act? You would just relabel the claim as negligence, and it would then pass muster. So I'm having a little difficulty with that.
Your Honor, I think that's an issue of legislative intent, and the legislative intent is expressed in the statute where it says it's designed to prevent nuisance lawsuits. So, you know, I think relabeling a claim or bringing a nuisance claim perhaps avoids the problems inherent in the Right to Farm Act question.
Well, but what would the words results from mean if those words aren't a reference to proximate cause? What would be the purpose of completely disconnecting the negligence from the nuisance in a statute?
Well, if the defendants are not negligently operating this CAFO, then it could smell as bad as anybody wanted it to smell, and nobody could do anything. So the first question you have to ask is there negligent operation? Once you get there, the issue is not whether there would be no smell if there was not negligent operation, but whether or not negligent operation contributes to cause it. And I believe there's certainly evidence in the record with regard to causation, but a lot of the issue was confused because Dr. Sheffield was not called on causation. He was called on negligence. And we believe that causation in a case like this, particularly a nuisance case, is more a question for the jury, and unless there's just an overwhelming degree of evidence that says that there's not a nuisance or there's not there's not negligence. And I don't believe that's in the record.
See, I mean, it seems to me that Indiana case law specifically recognizes that a pig farm is going to smell bad even if it's run in a perfectly competent manner. And I'm not going to eat pig for the next year.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's unreasonable to expect that anyone would be able to, in some cognizable way, quantify the degree of smell from anything. If that were the case, none of us would experience that unpleasant feeling that we have when we ride up in an elevator with something and they're wearing so much cloying perfume we can barely breathe. The way that smells are perceived is different by different people. And I would agree that there is going to be some smell, but in this case it's a matter of smells, it's a matter of flies, it's a matter of how they put this the manure out there on the farm for application. There are numerous things. There, on page 20 of our opening brief, we listed all the things that were negligent. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Well, you seem to agree then, if this thing is operated efficiently and properly and still stinks, that's tough, right?
If it is operated efficiently and there is no negligence in the operation of it, if it smells like Grogan's goat, Your Honor, under the Right to Farm Act, you're out of court.
Right. We're talking about pigs, not goats, but that doesn't matter because I think if we get to that, then it all comes down to whether or not, I guess, you think it's negligently operated or efficiently operated, and that's where we are.
I think that's right. But I do believe the causation inquiry is one for the jury.
Well, does that mean you're abandoning the argument based on the change clause, the substantial change clause in the statute?
I believe what we argued was not that there was a substantial change in the condition of the farm, but that there was not a change in the condition of the locality.
I know that that's what you're arguing, but that's the issue you didn't raise in the district court.
That is correct, Your Honor. I don't believe we're abandoning that. I believe we had ample evidence of negligence, we had ample evidence of causation, and that it should have been a jury question. And the court...
I don't want to sound like a simpleton, but... A hog farm that would be run in a non-negligent manner, how would it smell any better?
Well, Your Honor, if appropriate biofilters are used and covers are used on top of a lagoon, it has to be a system approach. You take an approach to minimize, through systems, all of the things that produce smells. There are over 250 organic components and inorganic components in hog smell. What produces a particular odor on a particular day may be any one or more of those components. So you can't just do one thing and escape the idea that you're not being negligent. But if you apply all of those things in system, there will be a reduction in the amount of odor that comes from the farm. That's the testimony we believe is in the record, and we believe the science supports that. The court never got to the Daubert issue because they had ruled on the summary judgment motion first. But for what it's worth, I think that this is one of those situations where something that really is fairly simple, that hogs stink, is complicated by the fact that we're overthinking it. And as I said, we called Dr. Sheffield to establish the negligent operation, not causation, because we believe that causation is something that a reasonable jury can determine. Anybody who's driven by a hog farm in the morning knows what hog farms smell like and whether or not it's a nuisance. And we certainly had testimony in the record from our clients with regard to the level and the degree to which this interfered with their normal daily activities.
What do they call the place where they put the dead animals?
They call it a mortality composter, Your Honor.
Now, that seems to be something that was at least questionably about how well it... Well, it's, I don't even know how it works, but apparently it wasn't properly attended to. That would seem to be something that I guess happens with when you have a lot of animals. They die and you got to do something with them.
Your Honor, when pigs are confined in a large operation like this, some of them die, I guess, from porcine stress syndrome, among other things. And they are collected and put into this composter, which, as I understand it, is designed to produce some kind of reusable material, much the way you compost lawn clippings. Only in this case, you're composting dead animals.
And they decay, I guess, and there's, you put sawdust on top of them or something, and there was a sow half sticking out or something in one of the
right.
places. But I guess it's this thing was pre-approved by the state that seems to know how you're supposed to set one of these things up. There are lots of different CAFOs, as you know, different animals, and people generally complain because it's a factory farm and all that stuff, and that's what we eat when we go to the store. But I guess I don't know how you're going to talk about negligence or how this thing isn't correctly operated. It's pre-approved. It must have had been properly designed. Some things leach out, but if it smells, it should be for a fairly confined area. If the wind blows hard, I guess it gets... I guess it was a question between manure and decaying animals. But,
well, Your Honor, I don't think we raised the issue that it was not properly designed. I think what we said is it's not properly operated. The defendants make reference in their brief to it being mismanaged. I think we should call it what it is. It's negligence when you fail to operate it in the way that it's designed. That's the key difference to me. The composter may indeed have been properly designed, and it simply has been improperly operated. And again, we believe there's ample evidence in the record to establish negligent operation. The Mr. Spear, who hired me to represent this case on appeal, said that when he read the first five pages of the judge's order, he thought he'd won. But the causation analysis later proved him wrong, because the judge went through this list of things that he found to be negligent operation. He simply could not make the causation piece based on Dr. Sheffield's testimony. and Dr. Sheffield was never really called for causation.
You talk about the cause of the odor?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the question came down to whether or not there would be no odor if everything was operated correctly. And I think that's probably the wrong inquiry. The question is whether or not if you take a systems approach and you mitigate to the degree possible with the use of biofilters and other things, the way that this smell comes out of the farm, that will reduce the degree to which it is a nuisance. And that should be a question of fact for the jury. And even though an expert can have an opinion on that, I don't think any of us in here can qualify or quantify how much smell anything has. It's simply not possible.
Would you use comparables? You go to, here's the perfect farm, and somebody goes out there and says it doesn't smell very much, or it does smell a lot. How is a jury going to decide when a farm is operating correctly and not?
Well, in terms of the negligence.
Based on some looking around, find out there's manure in the corner, and maybe that compost wasn't operated correctly, at least on that day.
In terms of the... of this case, I think the negligence aspect is given to us by Sheffield, and then the causation piece is delivered by the plaintiffs. This smell is so bad that it interferes with their lives. And, the defendants used an analogy to medical malpractice cases when they talked about but-for causation, saying and arguing essentially that you need an expert to say that there's causation here. And I don't believe that's a proper use for an expert. I think that probably invades the province of the jury to a certain extent, simply because, like I said, it's just impossible to quantify smell. I mean, I don't know how anyone could do it. And I think if you read the opinion, the judge certainly found there was negligence. He just got hung up on the issue of causation. If you would permit a sports metaphor, it's... In 1985, the Kansas City Royals were playing in Game 6, and Don Dinkinger blew a call because, as he said later, I was just too close to it. And I think the judge here was a little bit too close to this issue in terms of looking at trying to establish but-for causation only through Dr. Sheffield's testimony. I think you have to look at all the evidence in the record, and I believe all of the evidence in the record supports causation. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Well, if you're talking about my question, I don't know. It's because you talk about the causation, because everybody knows that it smells, and now what's the cause? And if this goes before a jury, depends where they're from. If somebody grew up on a farm or lives out in the country, this kind of thing kind of gives it a shrug. In the city, of course, if you live in where I am from, South Bend, where you have downwind from an ethanol plant, it's when the wind blows that way, it smells bad. At least some people think it smells bad. Others think it smells like a brewery or so. You know, it's in the nose of the beholder, I guess.
That is true. But in the absence of being able to have any particular piece of equipment that can quantify smell, the only thing we can quantify is parts per million of different compounds. And those do not necessarily equate directly to odor. And in that sense, these are overly complicated. Your Honor, I'm into my rebuttal time. May I be excused?
Certainly, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Niebarger.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This is a classic case of waiver. The main arguments asserted on appeal by these appellants wasn't presented to the district court.
But can you distinguish the waiver here from the situation in AMCAST?
I believe I
can.
And
would, forgive me, but would you concede that we retain the discretion to address these arguments even if the plaintiffs waived them?
I concede that in an issue of pure law, or an issue of comedy, or an issue of jurisdiction, that this, if those are the issues that, yes, I agree with you, you have the discretion. But I think the problem here is, in an issue of pure law, it's a situation where you don't need any facts. The entire factual record would be before you. You would have everything you need to render a final decision, not just kick it back to the district court.
You know, the plaintiffs really did raise a very interesting hypothetical on, it's on page 15 of the reply brief, so you haven't had a chance. So, may a company purchase a blighted city block in Indianapolis, plant a tomato garden for a year, and then convert it to a pig farm? You know, with impunity, would the Right of Farm Act allow such a scenario under your reading of the law?
No, Your Honor. The Right to Farm Act, at its fundamental purpose, looks to see, did you place this operation in the appropriate place? It would be, and I have to say, insane thing to think that the zoning laws, which also is comported with these acts, would allow someone to put a hog operation in the middle of the city of Indianapolis. That is what the Right to Farm Act looks to do. You have an agricultural operation. Did you put it in the appropriate area? How do we know what an appropriate area is? We look. In the surrounding area, are there agricultural operations? Is it a rural area? What is the zoning? Is it residential? Is it industrial?
Yeah, but sometimes things start to encroach, you know?
Yes, Your Honor, things do start to encroach, and the Right to Farm Act addresses that in part. I believe that the appellants here waived that argument, and I think the district court found that they waived that argument. And so, if that's the case, then appellants really needed to address the waiver determination in their opening brief. They didn't do so. They waited until the reply brief on appeal to raise these issues. And I believe if you wanted to talk about waiver, Your Honor, I equate it more to the broadest case, which is cited in our brief.
Did you say the locks?
The broadest case.
Oh, the broadest.
Yes, Your
Honor.
In the broadest case, the defendant attempted to avoid summary judgment by raising a legal argument on a statute of limitations, a tolling argument, for the first time on appeal. And this court said no. It invoked the common idiom that you don't get to switch horses in midstream. Why?
Pigs in this case.
That's right. Appellants chose their defense strategy in the motion for summary judgment, and they're bound by that choice. And allowing the appellants to raise this new strategy for the first time on appeal would undermine the essential function of the court to adjudicate. Why? Because there would be a factual record. We would need a factual record of the vicinity of the locality, any potential changes in the vicinity of the locality, any potential changes in use by the appellant plaintiffs below. The district court, who would make those decisions, because it's a neutral arbitrator, right? It takes the facts, the law, the arguments, and the evidence presented to it to make that determination. And it's different, Your Honor, I suggest, than AMCAS, because this is not the case, and this is important, where the defendants merely just left something out. To the contrary, both the appellants and the appellees below agreed on what the proper determination was for the Right to Farm Act below. Both the appellants and the plaintiffs agreed that to invoke the Right to Farm Act, the defendants below were required to prove that the agricultural operation began more than 1 year before plaintiffs filed their suit, that there has been no significant change in the operation, and the operation would not have been a nuisance at the time it began on that locality. And if you look at Docket 200, pages 28 through 34, and Docket 199, pages 8 through 10, you'll see that agreement and that argument by the plaintiffs below. And I want to address one thing that was made apparent to Your Honor. It was said, I don't know if the Wendt case ever crossed the minds of these other lawyers who handled the case at the district court. Well, of course it did. The Wendt case was cited in the briefing before the district court. One would assume, one would hope, that if they cited that case, they would have read it. So this is a case where everyone agreed what the arguments were, and then, midstream, they want to change their argument.
I want to ask you if you could give me an example of what you think would constitute changed conditions in the vicinity. I'm talking about the language from the statute and also the language from the Laux, if that's how you pronounce its case, that was cited on page 27.
I think the traditional notion of a change in the vicinity of the locality would be, where some of these cases discuss, you have a developer who's now going to develop a subdivision. The traditional notion would be the encroachment of suburban America on the agricultural operations. That would be the traditional notion of a change in the vicinity of the locality. I don't believe it's merely one plaintiff buying a house. But, of course, that's not an issue in this case. And, Your Honor, if we could talk about the Right to Farm Act, I believe that we have met, and the undisputed evidence shows, that we've met the three requirements that all the parties agreed on were at issue before the district court to invoke its application. and that was that there has been a continuous operation for 1 year prior to the time that the plaintiffs filed their lawsuit. There has not been a significant change, and it was not a nuisance again on the locality.
When you say that there's not been a change from what period of time?
Well, it would have been...
You say 1 year. Obviously, this operation was set up, what is it, in 07?
No, the operation was set up in 2005, and I think that's important. In 2005, the Indiana legislature amended the statute to talk about, with respect to agricultural operations, what is not a significant change. And one thing that the Indiana legislature said that is not a significant change is the conversion from one type of agricultural to another.
Well, they're not going from beans to corn. They're talking about this. I mean, this is a substantial change. It's from row cropping, as they could call it, to a capo operation, which is pretty. That just from a layman's standpoint, that looks like a big change. Now, that's still total farming. It's a different type.
Correct, Your Honor. From the layman's standpoint,
and I guess
agree.
When we're talking about a change in whatever it is, there's no significant change in the type of operation. Significant change in the type of the agriculture operation does not include the following. And then a conversion from one type of agriculture operation to another. Is that what you're saying? It's whatever.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with you that in the common sense it seems like it's a substantial change.
And that's what worries me about a jury, that's all. Because it's obvious this is much different than it was before it started.
And the legislature said that we're going to protect that type of change. We're not going to allow that to basically break the change of continuity of an operation. So you can have an industrial or an agricultural operation that began in 2005, like we have here, that was crop farming, and you can change or convert that type from crop farming to hog farming, and you are still protected under this act. That was the import of the 2000.
What is a substantial change for the purpose of the statute?
Your Honor, for the purpose of the statute, I'm glad you asked that. This statute, unlike many other statutes, addresses two things, industrial operations and agricultural operations. So what they did, the Indiana legislature did, was define what is not a significant change in an agricultural operation only.
I'm asking what, in your view, is a significant change.
Your Honor, I can't stand before you and tell you what is a significant change.
Isn't that a problem? The way you read the statute, I don't think there are any significant changes. Statute says if there's a significant change, then the plaintiffs can sue. And then it says, but a change in kind of agricultural operation isn't. A change in size isn't. Well, what else would there be? Right? It's very strange to have a statute that first says, here's the rule, here's the main rule, significant change allows suit. And second, nothing is a significant change. That suggests that something has gone wrong in the legislative process.
Well, Your Honor, I think that what we have to deal with as a defendant, it would be the plaintiff's burden to come up with something that is a significant change.
It's not burdens. This is a statute. Statutes have meaning. We don't think of burdens in figuring out the meaning of statutes. Right? If you were to be able to suggest something that would be a significant change on your reading of the statute, we could figure out whether that makes the statute make sense. But you can't. Nor, so far as I can tell, can anybody else.
The
statute appears to be internally contradictory. Now, Mr. DeWitt just said he isn't relying on the significant change business anyway, so we don't have to worry about the internal contradiction. But it's always a little difficult when somebody throws up a statute which appears to say A and not A at the same time.
I understand, Your Honor. And the legislature specifically addressed what was going on in Indiana when it made those amendments. That's why it made those changes. With respect to the industrial, it doesn't say that with respect to an industrial operation. And this statute addresses both. Your Honor, in the time that I have, I would like to address the causation element. I believe that the district court correctly found that the plaintiffs did not present evidence that the negligent operation was the proximate cause. What appellants are telling you is that there is not a proximate cause requirement or a causation requirement. But the language of the statute is express. It says that if a nuisance, quote, results from, close quote, negligent operation, then the act will not apply. And courts have interpreted as much. That's what the DeGroote case says. And here the evidence of causation was going to come from an expert. And here's why we know why.
Could I stop you? This is terrible. But you see, you cited evidence that several of the plaintiffs have raised hogs on their properties in the past. So they'd be familiar with the smells that are normally attendant to raising hogs. And they'd be able, it seems to me, to confidently, you know, testify that the smells coming from the defendant's farm are unusual enough to constitute a nuisance. So, in combination with the expert's report regarding negligence, why wouldn't those two things be enough to defeat summary judgment?
Your Honor, we specifically asked the plaintiffs in this case, what is negligence? And what they have said unanimously, every single one of them, I can't tell you what's negligent. We're going to rely on experts to tell you everything related to negligence. They put their expert first and front on those issues. All you've heard is testimony that they believe it smells. That's all you have. There has to be, under the DeGroote case and under the plain language of the statute, approximate causation. And they haven't been able to provide it to you. That's one of the things that we cite in our brief, the Hardiman case. It says you can't just establish or provide testimony to say, expert testimony, that it's possible there's causation. The requirement is that there must be a probability of causation. And the Hardiman case brings that right to the forefront. Because in the Hardiman case, what did the expert say? The expert said that there's a 95% probability that the plaintiff contracted the disease, hepatitis, at the defendant's facility. So the testimony established that the defendant's negligence was, more likely than not, the cause of the injury at the facility. Here all we have is mere arguments of possibility. And again, you put your finger on it, Your Honor, is this is not the case where you aren't going to have odors. You are going to have odors from a hog farm, whether it's well-run or not well-run. It's an important distinction because, as the Chateau case said, a well-run, non-negligent facility will have odors. So the appellants must establish that the negligent operations, as opposed to the normal non-negligent operations, was the cause of the nuisance. And they fell short in that regard. The important part, Your Honor, is if you look at the causation, it was a twofold analysis opinion. If you correct, the expert said, if you correct everything that I say is negligent and you add 60% biofiltration to these barns, then the appellants will not experience a nuisance. The problem is that the expert admitted that it was not improper for the defendants to not install 60% biofiltration because that did not violate any accepted practice at any point in time. So what are you left with? You're left with an opinion by the plaintiff's own expert that says, even if the defendants did everything and cured everything that I said was negligent, the plaintiffs would still experience a nuisance. There is no tie between negligent operations and the nuisance.
Surely must mean the plaintiffs would still experience a smell. If they were experiencing a nuisance, then they could get recovery.
In Your Honor, they have not been able to provide any proximate causation testimony by an expert, because the expert didn't do any testing, frankly. Didn't do any testing to establish that the negligent operations was the proximate cause of this nuisance. And that's what the Act requires. And that's what DeGroote expressly says that the Act requires.
Well, if the smell is the nuisance, and it's obvious that that's the proximate cause, then that doesn't get anywhere. It just goes around in a circle. You know the smell's coming from the farm.
All they can tell you, is that there's a smell coming from the farm.
And that's all we know after all of this discussion. It's coming from the farm. And you're saying, well, it's going to come anyway,
no matter what, and
we don't know how much variations are going to be. So what is the – is there – it's Judge Easterbrook's asking, when is there going to be causation that's as a result of negligence, as a result of just because it's the farm?
Well, the DeGroote is a prime example, because in DeGroote there was runoff, and it was a mile downstream.
That was cows, wasn't it?
Well, sure, but the manure spill would still be the same.
That was a CAFO. Sorry.
And so then you would have an example of, if the runoff affected the groundwater or the plaintiff, you would have proximate causation. Or if you'd done comparable testing, as Your Honor mentioned. I see my time has expired. I request that you affirm the district court's opinion. Thank you, Your Honors.
Niebarger? Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Matt Elliott. I'm here on behalf of Don Lease, who has been sued on an individual basis in this case. Mr. Lease, along with his wife Barbara, are members of an LLC called Donbar Investments LLC. Donbar is short for Don and Barbara. As the court is aware, Donbar is the landlord at this facility. Country View is the tenant, and pursuant to their arrangement, Country View operates the farms, Country View owns the hogs, and Donbar takes care of the manure. Plaintiffs have not been content to sue Donbar and Country View. They have brought in Don Lease on an individual basis for some reason, and they have chosen not to let him out. And so that is why I am here today. Based on the briefing from plaintiffs' counsel and based on what we've heard so far, it almost seems that the claims against Mr. Lease are an afterthought because no one has really mentioned them. But let me assure you that they're not an afterthought to Mr. Lease. He would very much like to get out of this case no matter what happens with respect to the rest of the claims. Thus, while we support the global arguments by the defendants, we have a separate basis to get out of the case as well. And that's
he farms the surrounding area, right?
That's right,
and
Your Honor.
And he spreads the manure, whatever they do with it, and that sort of
well,
thing?
Well, Donbar is the one that hires applicators to spread the manure. All Mr. Lease does is grow corn and beans on the neighboring fields on a rotating basis every year, just like thousands of other farmers in Indiana. We would submit that growing corn and beans does not create an odor, growing corn and beans does not cause a nuisance, and growing corn and beans cannot create any liability for Mr. Lease.
Was he the prior owner of the parcel where the farm, where the
That's right, Your Honor. Then it was conveyed to Donbar, the entity, before it was built. And then Donbar's the one that constructed it pursuant to the specifications of Country View and IDEM.
And he's a member of that or whatever it is.
That Mr. Lease is a member of Donbar. That's correct, Your Honor. And there's been a suggestion in the briefing that this issue is not properly before the court because the district court did not reach it. As Mr. DeWitt mentioned in his opening, of course, this court can reach the issue no matter what happens with the rest of the case because it can affirm on any ground, and we brought this issue up in the district court and fully briefed it. And so it's really just that simple. I'd be happy to entertain any questions, but from our perspective, Mr. Lease is a corn and bean farmer, at least in his individual capacity. He's not creating any odor, which is what this case is about, and therefore he was properly entitled to summary judgment. No matter what happens to the rest of the case. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. DeWitt?
Your Honor, briefly, my co-counsel tell me I did a bad job of explaining the issue of causation. Dr. Sheffield testified that the negligence caused excessive odors on the property, and that was bolstered by the testimony of the individual plaintiffs. I think that the other issue with regard to waiver, and I may not have hit this, is that the Toff Toy and TDM Farms cases came out after this was briefed to the court, and we didn't have benefit of those for briefing before the district court, and that's another reason not to apply the rule of waiver. Your Honor, I didn't realize you were throwing me a life rope when you asked about the issue of what constitutes a changed circumstance. My reading of that statute was such that it appeared to be so draconian that there was I was not going to argue against the plain language of the statute when I am
Indeed,
asking you to apply
I didn't see any such argument in your appellate brief.
Pardon me?
I didn't see any such argument in your appellate brief. We have the curiosity that the principal argument on appeal was not raised in the district court, may well have been waived, and the principal argument in the district court has been abandoned.
Well, I think that that may a little overstate the case, but I understand where the court's coming from in that regard. I would still ask that this court reverse and remand. I think the causation evidence is there in the record, and the court asked good questions. I hope I've done a fair job of explaining our position. I respectfully thank the court for its time and look forward to your decision.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.